Hello and welcome to the latest Moneymakers Weekly Investment Trust podcast. I'm Jonathan Davis, the editor of the Investment Trust Handbook, and your host for this weekly review of all the latest news and developments affecting the investment trust sector. My thanks to JP Morgan Asset Management for agreeing to sponsor the podcast, which as a result will now remain free for the foreseeable future. Moneymakers is an independent research and publishing venture with a mission to explain and inform. But I must remind you that for regulatory reasons, nothing you hear from any speaker today should be regarded as constituting individual investment advice. This week on the podcast, I sit down for an extended conversation with Peter Spiller, who I hope won't mind being described as the grand old man of the investment trust scene. Having worked in the city for 50 years or so and managed Capital Gearing, the all-weather investment trust for more than 40 years, making him the longest-serving manager in the sector. We discuss a wide range of challenges that are very much on the minds of investment trust investors at the moment, including cost disclosure, regulation, consolidation, liquidity, tender offers, discounts, share buybacks, and the overriding importance of good corporate governance. In the course of our conversation, he names some names of boards or managers that he thinks have fallen short of the high standards he believes shareholders deserve, and makes the point that there are several others that he does not name, but only because he and his colleagues are currently engaged in discussions with them about their recent performance. It's good to know that we have such an experienced veteran of the industry on our case. In the markets, there are further signs of rotation in global equity markets, with the Chinese and Hong Kong markets leading the way, with gains of 2.8% and 2.1% respectively, while the Nikkei in Japan, which has been very strong over the past year, was down by 2.5%, Nasdaq by 0.7%, and the S&P 500 by 0.1%. The picture was mixed over here as well, with the FTSE up a short 1%, but the 250 index down by 0.4%. Bond yields, meanwhile, move notably higher on both sides of the Atlantic, with once bullish investors increasingly seeming to fall into line with the Federal Reserve's more cautious thinking about the scale and likelihood of interest rate cuts this year. Oil prices edged above the $80 barrel mark, while gold sold off a little after its recent strong run. Higher bond yields probably had quite a lot to do with explaining the disappointing performance of the Investment Trust Index this week, which was down 0.8%. Losers there outnumbering gainers by around 3-2, while the average discount moved out again back towards 16%. There were some sharp moves on either side of the ledger, with the high-flying Indian equity trusts among the bigger losers and Chinese trusts again amongst the leaders. Most alternatives found themselves in the red, which is where you can see, I think, the influence of those movements in bond yields. As always, you can find tables of the best and worst performers in the investment trust universe. That's share price, NAV, and discount movements as a subscriber to the Moneymaker Circle, where this week our in-depth profile features Majedi Investments. And our weekly email includes our comprehensive summary of all the latest news from the sector and comments on last week's Master Investor Show and long-term trust performance. There were more results out this week, with pride of place going to Allianz Technology, whose NAV total return in 2023 was a striking 46%, but still failed to beat its benchmark, thanks to a modest underweight in the biggest gainers from the AI surge. That's Nvidia, of course, and others that might benefit. Followed by Manchester and London, ticker MNL, whose NAV total return was up 25% at just the interim stage. That being another specialist trust that has a strong bias towards technology stocks. Other trusts reporting double-digit gains at the full-year level include AVI Japan Opportunity, ticker AJOT, which put in a credible performance nearly 7% ahead of its benchmark, Canadian General Investments, ticker CGI, and HG Capital, whose NAV total return was 11%. Schroder Asian Total Return, meanwhile, that's ticker ATR, delivered 8.8% NAV total return and also beat its benchmark by 7%. Again, we have our normal full list of all the results, as I said, in the weekly email. With industry consolidation very much in the news, this week saw the announcement of another proposed merger, this one between Janus Henderson's two European trusts, that's Henderson European Focus, ticker HEFT, and Henderson Eurotrust, ticker HNE, which when combined will transform the two smallest trusts in the sector into a £750 million market cap fund that is second only in scale to Fidelity European. Henderson European Focus Trust will be the continuing vehicle here, although it remains to be seen exactly how the two managers who've been named as taking on the management of this trust after the merger will work together. The long-serving manager of Henderson European Focus, John Bennett, having recently announced his forthcoming retirement. Elsewhere, Custodian Property Income REIT, ticker CREI, has slightly improved the terms of its offer for Aberdeen Property Income. Shareholders have approved the merger of Troy Income and Growth with STS Global Income and Growth, another trust managed by Troy Asset Management. And the board of GCP Asset Backed Income, ticker GABI, G-A-B-I, has concluded its strategic review and will propose a managed wind down, having so far failed to attract any bidders for the whole company. Most significant of all, perhaps, this week is the news that the directors of Scottish Mortgage, the largest equity trust in the sector, are proposing a £1 billion share buyback programme in an attempt to reduce its persistent double-digit discount. The market actually seems to like that, marking up the shares by nearly 5% this week and the discount narrowing, evidence perhaps that simply the promise of a well-timed and sufficiently bold buyback programme can indeed produce results before it has even been implemented. Other boards, please note. So, as I mentioned earlier, I thought this would be a very good moment to catch up with Peter Spiller, who is the founder of CG Asset Management and has been manager of the Capital Gearing Trust for something in excess of 40 years, making him the longest serving manager in the investment trust universe. So if anyone can give us a longer term perspective on what's going on at the moment, Peter's your man. So, Peter, here we are. We're talking in Anno Domini 2024. And the great investment trust sector has been facing some challenges over the last couple of years, I think it's fair to say. And I wanted to talk to you about that. But I guess the sort of simplest way to sum up the problem is that there are classically more sellers than buyers. There's a shortage of liquidity in the market, both in terms of buyers and sellers, and also in the ability to trade easily in some of these issues. So how does this compare to other phases of the investment trust industry's history?
Well, John, I think it's a particularly poor period with respect to liquidity. And there are quite a lot of reasons for that. Essentially, governments and regulators have conspired against small companies in general and investment trusts in particular. So there are small things like, in their wisdom, brokers are not allowed to issue research to people they trade with without separate payment, so-called unbundling. And the result of that, entirely predictably, has been that very little independent research is done into smaller companies. So that's been very unhelpful, particularly to private clients. Secondly, we've had all sorts of regulatory changes, which, as interpreted by the FCA, have led wealth managers in particular to demand the compliance officers in those organizations to demand that clients with the same risk profile should achieve similar results. This is all about the avoidance of scandals that someone does badly. But of course, what it's meant is that no one can do well either. So that's been reinforced by the tendency among wealth managers to use models more and more, which means that everyone has to move at the same time. And that effect is further enhanced by the consolidation of wealth managers themselves. So we've got in prospect £100 billion on the management of one wealth manager. It's very clear that if those wealth managers are forced to invest in concert, then large parts of the trust market are excluded from their possible purchases. So what all this has meant, when allied to some perhaps temporary things, like huge redemptions in multi-asset funds, which have put pressure not so much on the equity part of the investment trust movement, but in the renewables and property and so forth, the REITs that have been the source of growth over the last few years. And on top of that, we've had cost disclosures, which I know you're going to raise later, but the effect of cost disclosures has been to more or less exclude private equity, venture capital, and companies which partially invest in such things, like Rich Capital, for instance, from the investment universe of those wealth managers. So the combination has been really quite devastating to, say, liquidity, And it has really meant that very large numbers of investment trusts, I'm afraid, just don't have any future as a useful service for private clients, or indeed for anyone else, in the foreseeable future. And I would say, people discuss what sort of level of size you now need to have to be viable, and increasingly looks like the answer is north of 500 million. So market caps of less than 500 and possibly even 600 now just look problematic. And so boards of directors have to respond to that, because although the government might retract some of the more foolish elements of MiFID, and the FCA might be persuaded that growth is an important feature of the UK economy, and just regulating away all risk does not help with that. And there's a private bill going through the House of Parliament at the moment. It may take some time, which may help on cost disclosures. But nevertheless, those fundamentals of large investors requiring substantial liquidity on behalf of groups of private clients will, I think, in all likelihood, persist. And therefore, boards need to recognize they've got to change. They have to change and respond to this new environment.
So deep literature that suggests that well-intentioned regulation often ends up producing the opposite effect to what it actually is intended to achieve. And maybe we're seeing a little bit of that at the moment. But as you say, it's not simply enough just to reverse the regulatory missteps, even if you can persuade the regulators that they are missteps, to see this kind of climate improve significantly. Would that be a fair summary of what you're saying?
Yes, I'm afraid it's unlikely, because the systems get set up in wealth managers, for instance, who are a very important feature of investors in investment trusts, and those structures are unlikely to be changed in any substantial degree, I would have thought, in the foreseeable future.
Okay, so you mentioned the importance, therefore, of boards responding to this. If the climate is, as you say, and no immediate prospect of a radical change in the environment, if you are a shareholder in an investment trust, you naturally will be hoping that even if your trust is going to go out of business, you will at least be able to go out at a fair price.
Right.
And that is the job of the boards to make sure that happens. I guess the question is that happening at the moment? Are you seeing enough action by boards recognizing these issues you identified and taking steps to resolve them? And if so, what are those steps going to be?
Well, I think, Jonathan, I'd be more constructive than that. Where I think we will get to in a few years' time, if all goes well, is very many fewer trusts, but those trusts being significantly bigger than they are now, and the total assets under management for investment trusts being greater than it is today. So to get there, we've got to consider a number of options. One, obviously, is consolidation. So all of this, I just should say by way of background, but didn't mean to sound at all as though boards have done nothing and haven't recognized the problem. There's a slight element of waiting for other people to move before they do. But I think most boards are very aware they've got a big issue to deal with here. So dealing with equity investment trusts, first of all, consolidation is an obvious route. There have been a few examples of consolidation. It remains expensive enough. So the fees charged by investment banks and so forth are still relatively high for the work that they have to do in putting trusts together. So that has been one barrier. So I would hope for some response from at least someone in what I'm tempted to call the cartel, which can offer a cheaper service. But I think that there are some very obvious examples, even among relatively big trusts. So BlackRock run a couple of small companies' funds, essentially identical. There's a small difference that one of them has a derivative portfolio alongside. Doesn't make a huge amount of difference, as far as I can see. And yet, there seems to be no discussion within BlackRock, certainly that I'm aware of, to putting them together. But that will be one obvious example. And there are plenty of other trusts which could do the same. The second thing they can do is what Capital Gearing Trust has done, which is go on to a zero discount model. And the reason why that works is that the liquidity that's relevant to the investor is not the liquidity provided by market makers. It's the liquidity provided by the underlying portfolio. So long as that portfolio is liquid, then people can redeem as much as they like, when they like, on terms close to the asset value. And if they can redeem, then they can buy. So I think it is a very good opportunity for people with a credible product. So obviously, investors have to be persuaded they want to have their money run by that organization, whatever it might be. So people with a poor record, that's not really an option. And that's a bit of a problem. But I have to say to you, Johnson, if investors don't want you to run their money, none of us have a God-given right to collect fees for the rest of our lives for looking after people's money who'd rather we didn't. So to come back to your earlier point, if they can get their money out at close to asset value, then that's probably a great idea. But I still think that actually merging with somebody else will be more constructive. But obviously, there always has to be an exit for people who don't want to participate in the merger.
So in other words, you're bringing supply and demand back into balance almost by force, as it were. Yeah.
Yeah. So one approach that has been taken, which I think is not a course I would recommend, is to do tender offers. So tender offers are often spoken of as a way of dealing with particular sellers. So if a seller has 10% of a trust and is saying that they want asset value for their holding, then the idea seems to be if you have a tender for 10%, then that takes care of it. But of course, the tender is not just to them, it's for anyone. And if there's a reasonable discount, then almost all the shares will be tendered. So the proportion held by the problematic shareholder remains pretty well unchanged. So it doesn't address the problem correctly, it seems to me. Although it is the route that is recommended, I think is perhaps the right word, by a number of American institutional holders of UK investment trusts.
Of whom we've heard a fair bit in the last few months, shall we say.
Yes, yes. So I won't mention names, but it doesn't seem to me a very rational way of going about it. Not least from their point of view, because if you get a tender every few years, sure, you make up the discount on what's tendered, but usually that's not a great deal more than the management costs over the period, the profit from that. And of course, you're shrinking the trust all the time and making it less and less liquid. So it's not a route to a flourishing trust. So I think that's a route which is often spoken of. I think, as I say, where the liquid assets underneath the trust are sufficiently realizable and sufficientized in a short time, then the ZDM is a much, much better model to go by. The second thing to mention, I think, is that investment trusts need to preserve the confidence of their holders. So we've had a recent discussion, which has been in the public eye, with Smithson, who had a clause in the prospectus which said that were the discount to average more than 10 this year in 2024, the board would consider a vote, a continuation vote. And it was indeed more than 10. The discount was more than 10. It's currently about 13, if I'm correct. And the board issued a statement saying they had consulted with the managers, not the shareholders, but with the managers. The managers had recommended they didn't have a vote and they weren't going to have one. So we kicked up a bit of a row about that, as I'm sure you've seen. And to their great credit, they have turned around. So not only is there going to be a vote, but that vote will be an ordinary vote requiring a 50% majority rather than a special, which would have required a 75% majority to wind up. So, no, well done there, and that's great. It's never easy to turn around, and that's super. But they also have a commitment to that 10%, which they're not keeping with the discount at 13 as we speak. And the reason for that is very similar to the position of a lot of trusts. So it's not that they do nothing. They know that discount's too wide, and this has a very broad application. They know the discount's too wide, and they do buy back, but they don't buy back enough. So anyone who's run an open-ended fund knows that when your sector is in favor, money pours in. And when it's out of favor, it pours out. And hopefully, the pouring out is less than the pouring in, and over time you grow. But the point of all these reassurances, particularly at times of issue of trusts, that if the discount is more than X, then they will deal with it, is precisely that if that sector, or indeed manager, but usually it's the sector, goes out of favor, then the shareholder will not suffer the double whammy of poor NAV performance and a growing discount on those assets in the share price.
I have heard the argument put forward, which seems to me to be specious, which is that the board say, well, we bought back some shares and it didn't do any good, so why should we carry on? It's obviously not working. I mean, that is a specious argument, isn't it?
It is specious because the first statement is fallacious. It is not that buying back shares isn't doing any good. It's buying back shares in the token size that we have done it has not done any good. So sometimes it's a bit more than token. I don't suggest that there hasn't been a really serious effort. But what boards do is completely underestimate the variability of demand for their product. And therefore, they aren't buying back nearly rigorously enough. And that rigor is really important because it's only with that rigor that the commitments made by the board are adhered to. And as I'm fond of saying, the word trust is the key word in investment trust. And it's really important for the movement as a whole to sustain confidence that when directors make statements, they will be adhered to. So with Swisscom, we're not out of the wood yet. They have made a very significant move. They are buying back stock, but they need to do it with much more rigor and get the discount back into single figures, as they have suggested that they would.
Do you actually think that the continuation vote is a good mechanism and everyone should have one?
Well, yes and no. They were introduced by the suggestion of investment banks because it became impossible to issue an equity investment trust when there were large prevailing discounts on most investment trusts. And the idea was that if you have a continuation vote, which might be in 5-7 years' time, whatever, you could say to investors, look, it might go to a discount in the short term, but you can count on the fact that it won't be at a discount at the end of that 5 or 7 years. Because turkeys don't vote for Christmas and no one will vote to continue a trust which trades at a discount. So that all sounds fine. But in practice, it turned out that for whatever reason, and perhaps that's a discussion for a much longer podcast, votes didn't work out like that. The most appallingly run trusts on large discounts wave through with 90% votes. I think possibly because of the game theory, that if the brokers have told each person that everybody else is voting to continue, and you're just making yourself unpopular if you vote against, then people just did. That's one possible explanation. It's really unclear as to what really did drive people to vote in that irrational way. So when I say yes and no, I think that the concept was an interesting one. But the practice has been that they haven't been much of a defense. Personally, I keep coming back to the same thesis, but I think that if the board credibly says there just simply will not be a substantial discount, then that makes more sense. Because every time they buy in at a small discount, they enhance the asset value. And the history of companies with ZDMs has been very satisfactory in the sense that their asset values have benefited and they have been the one sector in equity trusts that have grown. And the profits from even buying at small discounts in decent size, goes a long way to paying all the management fees, for instance, for those trusts. So that works out very well. Because the other feature of governance which has been missing is some sort of equivalence between enthusiasm to issue and enthusiasm to buy in. So I keep on picking on Smithson, but I will. So they issued £550 million worth of stock at a modest premium. But when it came back to buying in, they bought 150 roughly, 150 and change. And that was at a discount, which is now in double figures. So there's an imbalance there that I think is not to shareholders' advantage.
And the reason for that is, can one venture the opinion that maybe the board are listening too much to the fund managers and possibly to the brokers and not enough to shareholders?
Possibly. But I think one has to accept it's human nature. You want to grow. We all enjoy growing more than we enjoy getting smaller. So I don't attribute dark motives, Jonathan, to
the... Not dark motives, just the way of the world.
Yeah, but nevertheless, it should not be the way of investment trust boards. So there are other examples where there isn't a commitment. So BH Macro, for instance, has had, I think it's fair to say, a reasonably lackluster period of performance. They issued quite a lot when things were going well, but they've allowed their discount to drift out. As we speak, it's about 16%. And if you think about what the purpose of a quoted hedge fund of that kind is, it's surely defensive. People hold it in their portfolios because they want something with very low volatility. So the fact that it's moved to a 16% discount seems to me to let down those shareholders in really quite a major way. And the board needs to be just very much more active in response. And there I would say that, I mean, who knows what the motive is for not acting with any rigor so far, although they have done some. Actually, it's a very good example of how big the actual flows are and how rigorous you need to be. So this year, they've been buying back at an annual rate of 11.5% of all shares in this year to date. So, you know, tick for that. But what it demonstrates with absolute clarity is that it isn't enough, because otherwise it wouldn't have gone to a 16% discount. So given that they have a very liquid underlying portfolio, they just need to do much more. And then with any luck, things will turn around in the performance and their role will become more apparent, and they'll get back to a premium and they can issue again. That's lovely. So these are not recommendations to fall on the sword. Just that if you want to grow, you have to look after shareholders on the downside, make sure they don't suffer too badly.
Do you think any of the issues that you've just raised stem from the way that the whole IPO process operates in this country? In other words, the IPO, you bring a trust to market, the brokers market it, and quite often the board is the last thing to be appointed and they may or may not have the right range of qualifications and so on. Do you think there's an issue around board composition which has a bearing on board governance?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I would say boards have improved dramatically in the half century I've been involved in investment trusts. I always remember back in the days of Slater, who did have other problems, he always used to say he used to mark a board and you got 2 points for a general and 3 for an admiral and 3 for a peer. And the higher the score, the more likely it was really badly run and opportunity for him to take it over. So I think those days have gone. And to be honest, Jonathan, I think they were just as tokenish as any requirement now for diversity or whatever, much more, in fact. So I think boards have actually improved dramatically. And as I hope I've hinted, all the criticisms that I'm making don't arise from people not appreciating what the problems they have or how they should deal with them very often. It's just that they don't do it with enough vigor. But things have improved and we're getting better. And it's a progress which I think will be continued. And particularly, I hope it will be continued anyway, because those that are successful, that do operate in the way that I suggested, i.e. just make sure that the discount is where they need it to be, then those trusts will grow and that will reinforce good governance. Of course, what I should say, just to add to that, is that if the assets of a trust are illiquid,
I was going to come on to that. So we talked about equity trusts, but we haven't yet talked about renewables and alternative assets and how that fits into this picture where liquidity is obviously a much greater issue.
Right. So I think the position of those sort of trusts is very different. Interestingly enough, very large numbers of them were issued in the 2010s when interest rates were zero. And as a general statement, they were issued with loan-to-value targets, which were relatively high. Often 30 to 35 or 40% even. And that made great sense in the context of a zero interest rate environment, because very large parts of the profits that were made in that decade, right up until early 22, were made on the liability side of the balance sheet. So your assets didn't have to perform particularly well in real terms for you to do extremely well, because your liabilities were costing you a negative amount in real terms. So that was great, but things have sure changed now. So a big problem for many of those companies has been that they are overgeared for this environment. Their debt ratios are far too high, in my view, for the environment we're now in. And I should say, Jonathan, that we think that the new environment will prevail. In other words, that we're not going back to the sort of interest rates that we had. Because obviously, if you believe that we aren't going to go back, then that's fine. You needn't do anything about it. And the problem will resolve itself. So the result is that debt has been too high. And there's been, I have to say, quite slow recognition of that in the management of quite a lot of alternatives. So we're hearing much better things as we speak today. And we've been hearing commitments for quite a long time in our private talks to these people. But action has been relatively slow to follow in most cases. So if I pick out a renewable company like Next.
Next Energy Solar, this is, yeah.
Yeah. So they have an LTV of 46% of which 25 is floating rate.
Right. Yeah. Not particularly healthy, yeah.
So currently there's very little profit in borrowing at 7% or whatever these companies pay, I forget what next bit, to buy assets that yield after costs 7%, say, or even 8%. I mean, it's just not a commercial thing to do. In their particular case, they made a public commitment that they would sell assets to pay down that floating rate debt over a year ago. They have sold one, which was to a related party, which is always slightly unsatisfactory, but better than nothing, I guess. But we're still waiting for these asset sales to take place. Possibly that's because they're very reluctant to sell assets below the valuation that their valuers have put on them. I don't know. But all I can say is that shouldn't be an inhibition. If you only get 95%, then that's fine. You were overstating your assets. Shares are traded at a big discount anyway, so the market clearly doesn't believe the asset value. And they should need to get their balance sheets in shape. But the good news is that many of them throw off lots of cash. So if they keep their dividend constrained, so one of the features of the teens was because there was no alternative way of getting income, income was absolutely central to the case for buying these assets back in those days. Now there's plenty of opportunities. You can get very good income from bonds and gilts and tibble. And income is not so highly valued, but many of them do over-distribute. So they generally have to pay 85% out if they're in the investment trust sector. But there's been a lot of cases of over-distribution where they're paying more than that. I say over-distribution because they're having to borrow at that 7% rate, roughly, in order to pay me money on which I pay tax or my investors pay tax, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So they all need to get their balance sheets in order. And some of them are, I mean, do talk very well, actually. They talk a very good book as we speak, so I'm not unhopeful that this will happen. So that's great. But the other thing they can do, since their shares all trade at large discounts to their assets, is sell assets and buy in the shares. And the return, I don't need to remind you, I'm sure, if you can buy in your shares at a 25% discount and the value of the assets is correctly reflected in the asset value, then that's a 33% immediate profit, not annual profit, it's an immediate profit. Or put another way, probably about 5 years of the return on the asset. So it's pretty much a no-brainer to do that. And again, what I hope will happen is that when the balance sheets are in order and they bought back stock and therefore enhanced shareholder returns, whether or not that changes the rating in the short term, the very substantial returns that produce should, over time, garner enthusiasm for the shares and for the management, and then they'll go back to a premium. So in the case of renewables, obviously, none of this has been helped by a government which has introduced a levy on excess profits, which has raised almost no money and has managed to raise the cost of capital for all renewables, an area that they express enthusiasm for. So it's not very joined-up thinking. But we do need a lot more renewable energy. I mean, that is very clear. So it is likely that the environment will be reasonably favorable going forward. And those companies that enhance their returns now, say, by paying down their floating rate debt and buying in shares, will go to a premium, and I have every confidence, and then we, among others, will be happy to buy their shares to expand their business. So as with so much of the trust business, you have to shrink in order to grow.
Right. Do you think there's a behavioral issue with that? I mean, is there a behavioral reason why boards don't do it? They don't want to admit that they having to sell something below the stated net asset value may reflect badly on them, or, you know, is there a behavioral aspect to that, do you think?
Well, I think there has been a problem, particularly in the past. I say in the past because now the course of interest rates, if anything, is down. So in all probability, they wouldn't have to take much less than the latest valuations of their assets. I think it just takes time for people to absorb that the atmosphere is very different and the sectors are very different, and certainly the cost of capital has changed quite a lot.
Indeed, it has. So looking around this universe where we've got perhaps a lot more moving parts now than there used to be, in the sense of some boards are doing this, other boards are not doing so much and so on, is this actually a great opportunity for investors as well as a hopefully temporary problem?
Well, I think so, yes. I mean, discounts are very wide. Unfortunately, where they're very wide with illiquid smaller company assets, for instance, it's much less easy for the boards to respond to that I think there's some models out there which provide a medium-term solution. But I say it's unfortunate because actually there looks to be fantastic value in smaller companies' funds, for instance, where the underlying assets themselves, for much the same reasons of liquidity, are at very attractive valuations. So yes, for the long-term holder, there's definitely significant opportunity. There is a slight caveat to that, which is for smaller company trusts, for instance, the spread tends to be very wide. Say for the private client, even with a long-term view, if the spread's 8%, then it's got to do quite well. You've got to be very long-term before you get your money back just to pay for the spreads. So that's what it is. So I think the only solution for those with illiquid underlying assets are things like, well, BlackRock, I was a bit rude about their small companies trust not merging, but they do have this very good model for their emerging Europe, I think it's called, where you can subscribe every year to new shares and redeem every year. But when you redeem, you don't get paid out in cash, unless there are more subscribers than redeemers. But what you do is go into realization shares, so they're not forced sellers of illiquid assets in the short term. But I think that's a very good model. So again, it's games theory. If people believe they can get out, they're happy to go in, but not if they're not.
I mean, it has been said several times in the last few years, well, the future of investment trust lies in attracting more private investor interest. But one thing you just described, the phenomenon you just described, would sort of kind of work against that a little bit, unless you are a very, very long-term holder. And I guess that's probably why the people who want them for that reason, because they think they might be very long-term holders and not worry too much about what the price is today. What do you think about that?
Well, I think by far the best answer to that is to buy a trust with a ZDM, where you will be looked after with respect to the discount. So you just get the performance of the underlying assets, which hopefully can be very good.
Can I ask you finally whether you've got any thoughts on the issue of the UK market generally, of which investment trusts are a very important part, versus other markets around the world? There's been a lot of debate about whether there are things that should be done in order to make the UK equity market more attractive, more liquid, and more of interest to overseas investors and others. And of course, the investor trust sector, by and large, over the years has been, in the early years, driven by its large exposure to global investing. Do you think that that's going to change? And do you think there are things that the government can do or the regulators can do that will help to make it better?
Well, without going through the whole list that we started off with, yes, I do. There are some other simple things they could do, which I would not anticipate happening because they look like a handout to the middle classes. So getting rid of stamp duty, for instance.
Yes, I was hoping you might say that.
Well, because the interesting thing about stamp duty is that hedge funds and people don't pay it because they all do contracts for difference. So it's only the wretched long-term retail investor and so forth who actually do pay it. And it is unique in the world. It is quite extraordinary where we're trying to promote our market to maintain it. But I can quite see that the politics may not be helpful, as I say, as a handout to the middle classes rather than supporting the poor.
So in conclusion then, I mean, we started by talking, say, what challenging times it is. Would you say that there are some signs that things are moving in the right direction at least, and you have some grounds for optimism? Indeed, some things will turn out to be cheap and profitable for those who are brave enough to put their money into them.
Yeah, I absolutely do. So I think that, as I mentioned earlier, most boards understand what the problem is. Most boards are doing something about it, and they just need to be much more rigorous. But the consequence, if that turns out to be correct, will be that those discounts will prove to have been additional to your return, so that you will get a better return than that produced by the assets you invested in. And after all, what could be better than that?
What indeed. Thank you, Peter, for your time and a very interesting discussion. That was Peter Spiller, the founder of CG Asset Management and the lead manager of Capital Gearing Trust.
Thank you for listening. The Moneymakers Weekly Investment Trust podcast is independently produced and edited and is listed on all leading podcast channels. You can also sign up at the website money-makers.co to be notified every time a new podcast is available. Please note, these podcasts are provided for educational purposes only, and nothing you have heard from any of the speakers should be regarded as constituting investment advice. If you want more news, analysis, interviews, and other investment trust content, don't forget to look at the Moneymakers Circle, available now for a modest subscription at the website.